The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop, and today I want to talk to you about one of the most important tools you can use in the studio. That tool is references. Yes, someone else's music can make a big impact on your music, but you've got to make sure you're using references in the right way. I know that sounds a little weird, but there is a right and wrong way, in my opinion at least, to use references. At least there's ways of using them that I've seen really help people at every stage in the process, and ways that kind of get people bogged down or even confused, and they can be counterproductive if you're using them in counterproductive ways. So what do I mean by this? Well, we'll get into that real quick. But before I even talk about the specifics, I just want to let you know that references can be crucial at every step of the process. References can be amazing in helping you with songwriting, with arranging, with recording, with getting tones, and obviously with both mixing and mastering, where you hear references brought up the most. This is, like I said, an extremely powerful tool. And it's not only powerful in music, it's really powerful across creative disciplines. An author, you've probably heard of him, called Stephen King, once wrote, I believe in his book called On Writing, that if you don't have the time to read, then you don't have the time or the tools to write. And I think something really, really similar goes for music and audio production. If you don't have the time or the inclination to listen to recorded music, and to do so not only for pleasure, but from an analytical perspective, then you don't have the tools that you need to make great sounding recorded music. Now, an interesting thing here is Stephen King, he's not even one of my favorite authors. To be honest, I don't even read that much fiction, but I still read his book On Writing, and I took something out of it. And I think musical references are a lot like that too. You can get a lot out of references that, even if they're not necessarily your favorite records, even if they're artists you're not familiar with, and even occasionally if they're artists that you don't even like, there are things that you can learn. And I'm going to tell you what those things are and how you can do that without crushing your soul by listening to music you don't like too much. But there really is tremendous power here. So I'm going to give you some tips on how to use your references, whether you're doing the songwriting process, the pre-production process, in tracking, and of course, really importantly, in both mixing and in mastering, where I think they are crucial. But again, you don't want to use references in ways that are going to be counterproductive and mess you up more than help you out. All right, let's get into it. Real quick before we do, our 90 seconds or so of absolutely pure bliss while I shout out this week's sponsors. Those sponsors include Gear Club, another podcast, possibly the other best podcast in the world of audio and music production out there. Check them out at gear-club.net. That is gear-club.net, or type Gear Club into the Google machine or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you're listening to this right now. Just type in Gear Club. Amazing producer engineers, John Agnello, these guys, and Stu Lerman, these guys have been at it for decades and they keep on getting better and they are fun to listen to. Check them out at Gear Club. Also, big thanks to Focusrite. Speaking of reference, how do you like the reference quality sound of my voice coming through this new Focusrite Scarlett Pre they have me auditioning? I was using a Focusrite Claret Pre on prior podcast episodes. This one's through the Scarlett. It's even less expensive. I have like a souped up 18i8 here on my desk, and it's like 300 something bucks, incredible amount of I.O. This line is probably one of the most popular, if not the most popular, line of interfaces for audio ever made. So check them out if you're looking for an affordable or portable interface. All right. Last, certainly not least, SoundToys sponsoring this podcast from the beginning. Do you know why? Because they're awesome and they know an awesome podcast, just like you, when they hear one. So thank you, SoundToys, for sponsoring. If you haven't checked out their stuff, what are you waiting for? Go to soundtoys.com and check out everything they make for absolutely free. And if you don't own the SoundToys bundle yet, you should. Okay, so references, a right and a wrong way to use them? Well, man, references come in handy everywhere, whether you are recording, like I said, or even whether you're getting when you're getting used to a new room for the first time. And I think that's a especially essential place where references come in handy. And in each of these scenarios, you're going to want to think about the way you use them, and you may even select your references a little differently. I just want to say that in the beginning, I often used references in a really counterproductive way, and I'll point a few of those out. If you want some advice for what references you should pick yourself to be listening to in your studio, my colleague David Weiss at Sonic Scoop has put together a great series on references, and I'll link to that in the show notes. It is called Next Gen Reference Tracks, 12 Top Engineers Share Their Essential Reference Mixes. And I think it's an absolutely great article to check out. He's done this with a few others. He did Top Reference Tracks, Three Picks from Mastering Engineer Jeremy Lubzy, which is also worth checking out. And he's done some on references for recording strings and things. But definitely check out that article, Next Gen Reference Tracks, 12 Top Engineers Share Their Essential Reference Mixes. And coming up with general reference material that you pick yourself as a producer or as an engineer or as a mixer is essential for getting familiar with your environment. This is only one type of referencing, and we'll get into a few other types in a minute. But it is absolutely essential that you get to learn your space, your environment, and other environments. If you ever go traveling to do a recording session or a mix session, or you're hearing clients' work or your own work in an unfamiliar space, you really got to get in tune with the whole room and speaker system that you are in. And the way to do that is to play music you're familiar with. That sounds obvious, right? But there's a few things to look for in music that you are familiar with in order to get the most out of it. Absolutely, you want to look for tracks that don't only sound good to you, but sound good to other people, right? That are maybe somewhat acclaimed for how good they sound. But the most important thing is that you like them. You like listening to them again and again and again, because you're going to want to come back to these same tracks again and again and again. And they should tell you things that you need to know about sound systems. For instance, there's one track in my kind of little portfolio of reference tracks I break out that has really amazing stuff going on in the 40 to 50 hertz range, a kind of speedy but really deep kick drum. It's called Elephant Woman by a band called Blonde Redhead. Not everyone knows Blonde Redhead, but if you check out their record, Misery is a Butterfly, beautiful sounding record mixed by John Goodmanson at the Magic Shop studio on their beautiful Neve console. Tremendous sounding record. And the low end on that first track on the album, I can tell so much about a speaker system and a room I'm in based on the way that low end feels. Like I said, there's rapid things going on in that 40 or 50 hertz range. Some speakers are going to lie to me about that range. They're going to tell me nothing's happening there at all when I know there's something happening there. Some rooms are going to make that range sound really flubby and tubby, and I need to know that about a speaker system. Some speaker systems are going to give me kind of a one-note bass thing where there'll be a resonance that maybe isn't where I expect it to be. So that's huge for telling me that. I have another track that I use a lot. You've probably heard this one played at many a kind of a loungy restaurant in your life. It is called, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly because it's in French, La Femme d'Argent, which I believe means the silver woman. I hope it means the silver woman, by a band called Air. Maybe some of you guys have heard of the French band Air. This is off their first record, Moon Safari. But what that track tells me is what's going on in like the 70 to 80 hertz range. There is this iconic bass line in that track that goes on throughout it. It's super stable in dynamics, and it really occupies this one particular space in the low end that, again, tells me a lot about that register. Another cool thing about these tracks is I like them, so I don't mind listening to them again and again in so many different environments. Those are just two examples of tracks that tell me something about the low end that come immediately to mind for me for listening to rooms and things like that. And even if you're just a musician and you're not thinking about in such an analytical way like I am, it can be useful to have tracks like that that you can play through headphones at a new studio you're going to, or that you can listen to in a venue that you're going to be playing at, or you can listen to in a mixing or mastering environment you're going to be at. Tracks that you know you like listening to, you like the sound of, that tell you something about the system. That track Elephant Woman I mentioned by Blonde Redhead also has this cool thing going on with the vocal. It's one of these really pinched, gnarly, frequency-limited vocals that tells me something about how the mid-range of the speaker responds, whether it's pushing it forward or subduing it, or whether there's gnarliness going on in the crossover of the speaker. So again, just a couple of examples. There are so many examples out there. Older folks like to break out the Steely Dan, which came up in an episode of the podcast I did with Mauer Applebaum not too long ago, where I think he threatened to shoot his room designer if he played any Steely Dan in there. There are records by Paul Simon and James Taylor that people in that adult contemporary world like to listen to when they bring out again and again. Maybe a younger person in that adult contemporary world might be listening to Feist records. Maybe there's a certain Outkast record you love the sound of if you're doing hip-hop work. I like to break out the track called, I think it's called Happy Valentine's Day by Outkast, because it again tells me something about the low end in a track a little further up. And I like to break out like a Bruno Mars track, something like Uptown Funk will tell me something about how fast the transients are on a speaker system, or Michael Jackson's Thriller. There's also things you can learn from Slayer or Sepultura or Black Sabbath, but the most important thing when it comes to figuring out an environment that you're in is that you know the sound of these records and they tell you something about the system. But this is not the only way to use references. Another really important way to use references is very specific to mixing and mastering. And that is listening to the client's favorite records in the environment you're in so you can get in tune with the client. This is really important if you're a producer. It's also important if you're a mixer or if you're mastering. Me, when I'm doing mastering, especially remotely, one of the first things I want to do with a client is ask them, what records are you loving the sound of these days? It's not that we necessarily want to try to emulate those records, but I want to get in the same page with you as far as how bright is bright enough? How bassy is bassy enough? And we don't necessarily need to compare back and forth with these records all the time throughout the session, but it'll give us like a baseline. And if we get confused at some point and say, are we pushing this thing too bright? Are we pushing it too bassy? Are we going too loud and too saturated? Well, we can, at that point, go back and listen to some of these records that we know the artist is loving the sound of and say, oh, we're in the right world. Or, nah, we're going a little too dark compared to all of these. Or, you know what? We haven't put enough bass in. We can put in more bass. That's going to be fun. These are things you'll only really know in reference to the wider world. Now, I will offer a caveat here. There are some great mixing and mastering engineers who do not use references. Joe Lambert, who I trained under Joe Lambert Mastering, still one of my favorite mastering engineers to this day, you know, in conversation, he'll say, and I think he said in our podcast, yeah, I don't really use references. And that's true, but in a way it's false, because what Joe does is he sits in the same room every day, 5 days a week from 10 to 6, listening to a tremendous amount of music in there and never really going away from it for very long. But a lot of us who are recording and mixing may not be doing it every single day in the same room. We may not have our bodies so in tune to our environment where we're hearing so many records again and again and listening to so many, much new music, even just as lovers of music in that space, where we need to tune ourselves with references on a daily or session by session basis. There are other big mix engineers who've told me, yeah, I don't really use references. But what they do again is listen to again and again, 3, 4, 5 days a week in a row, music in that room and also records that they're interested in hearing in that room. But if you are not yet one of these people who is mastering or mixing 5 days in a row every week and listening to a tremendous amount of music in that room, and you're kind of referencing day by day in your daily life without even thinking of it as referencing, then you need to get a little bit more programmatic and intentional about using specific references. This is true even for me, because I right now am talking to you in a podcast and not mastering a record, right? I do part of my week in Sonic Scoop. I might only master 3 or 4 days this week and work on Sonic Scoop 3 or 4 days out of this week, right? I'm kind of a divided person. I don't just master. I don't just do podcasts and write articles and edit articles and put on events. I do both. So I need to consciously retune myself on a regular basis. I also might have a little bit more to prove than some of the very most established mixing and mastering engineers in the world. So I'm constantly comparing my work to their work and making sure it's as good. And I can say to my clients with confidence, yeah, when you leave here with this record, it's going to stand up on the shelf next to your favorite records made by some of the biggest mixing and mastering engineers on the planet. And it's going to do that, I know, because I listened to it next to all of those records, and it sounds great even in that context. And until you are one of those guys or gals with their names on a tremendous number of records people love, I think you need to be intentional about your referencing too when it comes to the mixing or mastering process. Now, I do want to repeat something. You can drive yourself crazy by A-Bing against references, particularly when you're mixing. And I think A-Bing against references has probably no place in the middle of a recording session. During a mastering session, I will, like I said, occasionally in the middle of a session, flip over to something else to kind of give myself a comparison and say, where are we bass-wise compared to this thing that I know we shouldn't have any more bass than this track, right? But during the mixing process, I'm going to caution you about doing it too often and bringing A-Bs too often into the mixing process. One of the things that newer mixers can really get distracted by when it comes to the references while they're mixing are trying to match some of the mastering things about it, right? How much low end there is, how much top end there is. And I'm really one of these believers in the idea that you shouldn't be mastering when you're mixing. Now, it's true, you should be getting your mixes to sound as good as possible and as close to fully mastered as possible so the mastering engineer doesn't have to do anything. But at the mixing stage, you really do that by focusing on the relationships between things and not spending too much time zoomed out and thinking about the macros of the low end and high end and comparing your mix to other mixes for amount of bottom and about amount of top back and forth too often. I'd really say that when it comes to mixing, at least in my experience, the time to reference is in the beginning and if you have a specific question. So when you're setting up your session, getting acclimated, getting a few things in your ear, just like listening to music in your space, getting in tune to the space, that I think is a good time to really listen. And then again, if you have, like I said, a specific question, is my vocal loud enough or can I push it louder? Is it too loud? If you're unsure of that, that's when listening to music in the genre that you're working on and music that you know your clients love the sound of, that's when listening to those things can be helpful. And you can say, well, here's how big the vocal sounds on these records and how here's how big it sounds in my records. I've answered that question. Let me put my references aside. I'm not going to A, B, and back and forth and try to match them, but I've reminded myself how hot is hot enough for a vocal. And I do think that in mixing, the more you do it, the less you can resort to references. But particularly in the beginning, I think that references are what's going to answer some of those big questions for you about how loud is loud enough for the vocal? How much reverb is too much reverb or not enough reverb? How much kick drum is too much kick drum or not enough kick drum? References will help you answer those specific questions during mixing. And as you get better and better, they'll answer those questions before you even get started mixing for the day. And as you get better and better and do it more and more, it'll answer those questions without referencing during a specific session, just by listening to music in your space and keeping constantly in tune with your space and with music in your space. I've been focusing on the engineering side of things, but like I said, references are not just for mixing and mastering and tuning rooms. References are also huge for producers and songwriters. And recently I had a friend ask me a question about their latest work that they had put out. They had put out a single that was really just acoustic guitar and vocal. And they were asking me, does it sound good? What do you think? And I said, well, it's pretty hard to mess up acoustic guitar and vocal. If it sounds like you guys in a room there, intimate enough without, you know, going too overboard on effects, you've done pretty good with an acoustic guitar and vocal. But then their question was, well, should what we're doing be more than just acoustic guitar and vocal? Should we be adding other elements? We're thinking about putting on some bass and some percussion. What do you think? It's like, well, what do I think? The better question is, you know, what do you think? And How are you going to come to that determination? Well, here's a great way, once again. Listen to some of your favorite records and take notes about what's happening in the arrangement that turns you on. Working with a producer on this stuff can be great, and having those conversations together, and a producer can guide you through that stuff. And in a way, this friend of mine was asking me for some advice as a producer. Unfortunately, I don't produce anymore. I just master, and when people ask me if I produce, I refer them to one of my producer clients who has sent me tracks for mastering. But the artists should be able to answer these questions for themselves too. And I really think that when it comes to figuring out what your arrangement should sound like, references are going to help you out immensely. Again, I'm not saying that you should emulate specific records that are out there, but I am saying that you should let your favorite music inform your decisions in a conscious way and say, here are the records that made the kind of impact that I want to make. Here are the kinds of records that mine is going to sit on the shelf next to. What are the arrangements like on those records? How sparse or how dense are they? What is the instrumentation like? What can I borrow from them that's similar, and what can I do that's different? So in a way, referencing is what you're doing already, just enjoying listening to music, which I hope you're doing. If you're working on music, I hope you're taking time to enjoy listening to music as well. It's doing that, enjoying listening to music while thinking about it consciously and saying, what questions that I'm facing in my own music can this music help me answer? And I think this is big for songwriters as well. Referencing songwriting, what am I going to do? I'm going to copy, I'm going to rip off someone else's songwriting style? No, not necessarily. But I can tell you, when I was early on in my career working with a lot of new bands, certain things I noticed would come up again and again with new artists. And here was a big one. Bands who had like a 32-bar intro before the song even starts. And it's like a 2 or 3 chord song with like a 16 or 32-bar intro with nothing going on. And if these guys had stopped and actually listened to some of their favorite records and said, how long are the intros on these things? They would find out that more often than not, their favorite records had intros that were like 2 bars, 4 bars, maybe a long one would be 8 bars. And in those rare cases where there's like a 16-bar intro or something, there is some interesting stuff going on. It is not just people vamping on chords for 16 bars or 32 bars. Maybe in some rare cases, there will be this slow ambient build that stretches out over 16 and 32 bars, but not on a lead single, right? These are things that you would know if you really sat down, listened to your music, analyzed what's going on structurally, and then asked the same questions of other music. And that can shed so much light. It can also shed light on the parts and the performances you're doing. A lot of new artists, again, if they're like a rock band or something playing together, you'll find drummers who are just like slamming on the crash cymbal or slamming on a hi-hat the entire time through a song. And then when you go and listen to your favorite records, you might find that the use of cymbals is actually much more sparse. Is this constantly being on the cymbal thing a habit they developed from being in bad rehearsal rooms where nobody could hear anything at all, or just not really thinking about what they were playing, or just needing that to be able to keep time? Are those why those things develop? I mean, there's certain genres where you're going to slam on the cymbal constantly on eighth notes, or there's certain tracks where that might be appropriate. But you got to think about those things consciously and really ask, this drum part that I'm playing, how does it sound really compared to drum parts on a lot of my favorite records? It also comes down to instrumentation in general. You know, guitar players can end up doing the same kind of thing where they get really strummy dummy and they're strumma, 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 right? Just like straight eighth notes or quarter notes or something for a whole track. Are they thinking about the way that guitar really sounds on some of their favorite arrangements? Now, again, a really disciplined, great, thoughtful producer is going to help artists make these decisions. And if you are interested in production, hopefully some of these guidelines I'm giving you are things that will come to mind for you when you are referencing against records and asking specific questions. But I think artists should be able to do this too, to at least some degree, with their own music, when it comes to the songwriting process, when it comes to arrangement decisions, and it's important also for engineers and producers when it comes to mixing and when it comes to mastering. The things I want to steer you away from, however, are letting references sap the creativity out of what you do. And I think that there are people who are afraid of that. And in a way, it's a legitimate fear. You can take references too far. But I would say the vast majority of artists and producers and engineers I meet don't suffer from the fate of relying too much on references and letting it sap their creativity. They suffer much more often from the fate of not really using references, not really asking great questions about what they're doing and why they're doing it, and not allowing other great music that they love help answer those questions. One way to keep from having references sap your creativity and originality is to use a lot of references that are outside of the genre that you're working on. And that can be especially helpful for arrangement ideas and songcraft ideas if you really want to kind of stand out from the crowd. I would suggest, though, when it comes to both mixing and mastering, that having at least a few things in the genre and in the time period that you're working in is huge. We need some other references as well to inform us, hey, this record is not coming out in the late 70s, or it's not coming out in the early 80s, it's not coming out in whatever time period some of these faraway references are coming from. It's coming out today. So when it comes to the sonics of mixing and the sonics of mastering, we need to really think about what records this is going to sit on the shelf against. And it is totally fine too, if you are confident enough in your career, to kind of go left on a track and throw people for a loop and make something that is significantly brighter or darker or quieter or louder or whatever than the current prevailing trends in your genre. That is fine as long as you are doing it consciously. But even in that context, I think it makes sense to bring up a bunch of modern records that you don't want to sound like and hear your tracks against them and say, we are doing something that's different than what has become the sonic norm. Let us go ahead and consciously do that and say, here's what we don't want to sound like. Well, I hope this has been a helpful episode of the podcast for you. I know that as my referencing has gotten better, I've been able to become more productive and more confident. Again, the biggest places for referencing are you, when you are tuning yourself to your room or a new room in a new environment. You got to have tracks that you've heard a lot of times in a lot of different places that you like a lot that tell you specific things about the space and speakers you're on. Make note of what those specific things are. Does it tell you something about the low end? What specifically about the low end does it tell you? Does it tell you something about the high end? What specifically? Does it tell you something about the mid-range? What specifically does it tell you about the mid-range? When you are mixing or mastering work for other clients, your references are going to probably err a little bit more towards tracks that they know they love the sound of. Whether that's the artist, if you're the producer and you know you're helping them realize their vision, or if it's the producer, when you're a mixer or mastering engineer working for a producer, finding out, you know, what their vision for this is and letting some of the things that they're referencing inform your choices. Finally, when it comes to both songwriting and arranging, I think you want to ask specific questions about your arrangement and about your song structure choices. And rather than just ask people around for their opinion, ask some of your favorite artists in history for their opinions by listening to their music and figuring out how they've handled some of these same questions in the past. I think you'll learn a lot about song structure in particular that way, and just how dense or just how sparse an arrangement can really be and really still work. Finally, when it comes to recording, I'm going to recommend you do most of your referencing up front at the beginning of the day and maybe during a lunch break rather than interspersed when you're actually recording. I think that's just bad taste on a tracking session. When it comes to mixing, I want to caution you that you will end up chasing your tail if you are constantly A-B-ing your mix against other mixes. You're going to focus on things that are a little more out of the scope of mixing and not spend enough time focusing on the things that really matter, like level balances and aesthetic choices and the like. I'm going to suggest that referencing when it comes to mixing is more for acclimating yourself in the beginning of the day, maybe again in the middle of the day, and then for answering specific questions if they arise about proportions. How much kick compared to how much bass, how much vocal or how much snare feels appropriate, how much reverb. Those questions can be answered with references rather than trying to really A, B, and emulate something specifically too much in the mixing stage. As you do this more and more and more day in and day out, referencing might not become as formal and specific of a process where you're asking specific questions, and it may be just something that you're doing without even realizing you're doing it, because you're just listening to great sounding music in your space and learning from it in an increasingly intuitive way. But I think that comes more and more as you've done this more and more, and particularly at the beginning and even intermediate and advanced intermediate and beginning advanced stages, you're going to be wanting to spend more time asking and answering specific questions with some references. And one thing that's never going to go away is when you go from one space to another and you want to get acclimated to new spaces, new speakers, you've got to have records that you like listening to, that you've listened to in a bunch of places, and that tell you something specific about the environment you're in. I hope this one has been useful for you. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Another big shout out to our sponsors for this one, Gear Club, the other best podcast in the whole world of audio music production podcasts. Check them out, gear-club.net. That is gear-club.net. Two fantastic producer engineers from New York City, John Agnello, Stu Lerman. They've worked on amazing records. Sharon Van Etten, St. Vincent, Aerosmith, Dinosaur Jr., Sonic Youth, a whole bunch of stuff together. Check those guys out at gear-club.net. That's gear-club.net. Also, thanks to Soundtoys, making some of the most creative effects out there for mixing and audio processing. And last, certainly not least, thanks to Focusrite, making some of the best affordable interfaces out there. Don't agree with me? Well, how could you not agree with me hearing the lovely sound of my voice through this lovely Focusrite Scarlett interface? And they make great high-end stuff too, all the way up to their RedNet series, where you can kind of link entire facilities together. They're a classic brand that's been around audio for a long, 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 long time, and they make some of the most affordable and most popular interfaces out there, like this new third-generation Scarlett line. If you want more advice from me on mixing or on mastering, you can also check out my courses at mixingbreakthroughs.com or masteringdemystified.com. Mastering Demystified, I'll tell you everything that I know about mastering. I guarantee it will make you better at mastering if you're just getting into it, and will help you out a lot even if you're just going to be working with a professional mastering engineer for the first time and want to get a lay of the land. Mixing Breakthroughs, I think there's breakthroughs in there for everybody. And if you had any breakthroughs from today's talk, I think you're going to have a ton of breakthroughs from that one. So check it out at mixingbreakthroughs.com. Thanks again for hanging out with me. See you next time.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.